Welcome back, everyone. Today, we're going to be taking a deep dive into a case that you all requested, and it's all about navigating the really tricky waters of delay damages and lost profits for new businesses.
Yeah, this case, Drewsco v. Leadwith Wolf Associates, Inc., it's a fascinating one. It's from 2001, comes out of the South Carolina Supreme Court, but you know what? It's still got some really important lessons for us even today.
It does. It really does. It's like, when you read through it, it's kind of like a cautionary tale,
Yeah.
even if you aren't in construction or thinking about opening a restaurant anytime soon.
Absolutely. And you know what struck me when I was looking at this case? It's just how much drama there is. I mean, it's like a law school exam question, but like in real life.
Yeah, you're right.
Right.
Okay, so before we get too deep into the weeds here, legally speaking, can you kind of give us a quick rundown of what actually happened in this case?
Sure. So picture this. You've got Drew's Construction Company. They're hired to renovate a building for Leadwith Wolf Associates, who are planning on opening this brand new restaurant. But as we all know, sometimes renovations, they don't exactly go according to plan.
Well, yeah.
There were delays, disputes over the quality of work, change orders flying back and forth. It was a mess. And eventually, the contractor just walked off the job.
Whoa, seriously. They just walked away.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine either side was too happy about that.
Oh, they were definitely not happy. The contractor, they slapped a mechanic's lien on the property, basically saying, "Hey, you can't touch this building until you pay me what you owe me," and then they sued to enforce that lien.
So they were playing hardball. What did the restaurant owners do?
Oh, they didn't back down either. They fired back with a counterclaim, arguing that the contractor, they breached the contract, and all these delays, the shoddy work, it cost them a ton of money. Not just to fix everything, but also because they couldn't open the restaurant on time.
Oh, right. So they lost out on all those potential profits.
Exactly.
Makes sense. So it sounds like this was, headed straight for a showdown in court. What happened at the trial?
Well, the jury's decision, it was actually kind of split. They awarded the contractor about $18,000 for the work they did complete, but they also sided with the restaurant owners and they gave them over $22,000 to cover, redoing the job, finishing it up, plus another $14,000 for those lost profits.
Wait, so both sides won something? That's not very common, is it?
Not at all. And as you might expect, neither side was particularly thrilled with this outcome. So naturally what happened, the contractor, they decided to appeal the decision, taking this whole thing all the way up to the South Carolina Supreme Court.
Okay, now that's where things start to get really interesting, I think, because this case, it goes way beyond just this one construction dispute, right? I mean, what were the big legal issues at play here?
Yeah, so the contractor's appeal, it really hinged on two main arguments. First, they claimed that the restaurant owners, they couldn't claim damages for the delays because there wasn't a specific completion date in the contract. And there also wasn't a time is of the essence clause.
So they were basically saying, no deadline, no problem.
Exactly. Their second argument was that new businesses like this restaurant that hadn't even opened yet, they shouldn't be allowed to claim lost profits at all. It's too speculative, they said.
Right. I mean, how can you really prove what a business that hasn't even opened yet would have made?
That's what they were saying. It's way too hard to prove.
Okay, so we're talking about two huge issues here. One, what's reasonable when we talk about timelines in a contract? And then two, do new businesses actually have any legal options when things go wrong? Let's break down that first argument about the, missing completion date. What did the Supreme Court have to say about that?
Well, the Supreme Court actually disagreed with the contractor. They said that even without a hard deadline, there's this implied obligation to finish the work within a reasonable time frame.
So basically, a reasonable time is implied, even if it's not written down.
Exactly. And the court also said the delays have to cause some kind of foreseeable harm to be actionable. So it's not just a lack of deadlines, it's got to be proven that those delays caused actual harm.
Okay, that makes sense. So contractors can't just use a missing deadline as an excuse to, drag their feet. But what about the other side of that? How does this protect the people who are, waiting for the work to be done?
Well, that's where this whole reasonableness standard gets really tricky. It also prevents people from making demands that are, unreasonable. It's got to be a genuinely reasonable time frame given the work being done, any unexpected circumstances,
So it's kind of a two-way street. Both sides got to be reasonable.
Exactly. It's a balancing act.
Right. And I mean, this seems like a really important concept that goes, way beyond just construction contracts.
Right.
I mean, think about it. deadlines for projects at work, you know, delivering services, even just personal agreements, this idea of reasonable time, it's kind of woven into our whole legal system.
It really is, and it's something we need to be aware of, whether or not it's explicitly stated.
Now, I see how this case, even though it's about a very specific situation, like, it has this much broader impact on how we think about contracts and, you know, our obligations in general. I'm curious, though, to hear more about that second big issue, the new business rule, and whether new ventures can actually claim those lost profits. I have a feeling this is where things get even more complicated.
You are not wrong about that. Traditionally, courts were super reluctant to award lost profits to new businesses, you know, because they saw it as just way too speculative. Like, how can you prove what a business that hasn't even opened its doors yet would have earned? It's a tough question.
So did this mean that the restaurant owners were basically out of luck when it came to their claim for lost profits? Did the Supreme Court, like, uphold that traditional rule?
This is where things get kind of interesting. So the court, they decided that it was time to modernize that rule. Yeah. They shifted away from just an automatic ban on lost profit claims and moved toward more of an evidence-based approach.
So instead of saying no outright, they actually looked at the evidence that was presented.
Yeah, exactly.
Hold on. So you're saying that new businesses actually can get compensated for lost profits?
Yeah, they can, but, and this is a big but, they need to prove those losses with a much higher level of certainty than they did before.
Okay, so it's no longer just a hard no, but they have a much bigger burden of proof now.
Right.
So now that raises a really important question. What kind of evidence would have, you know, convinced the court in this case?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the restaurant owners, they clearly thought that their claim was strong.
And that's the thing. It wasn't. The court found that their evidence was actually pretty weak. All they really presented were some rough estimates of their gross profits and the owner's testimony that like a third of that would be net profit. There were no detailed financial projections, no comparisons to similar restaurants in the area, no accounting for overhead costs or anything like that. It just wasn't enough.
So they basically just threw out some numbers without actually backing them up.
Exactly. And that's why their claim for lost profits, it just didn't hold up in court.
Okay, so this is a huge takeaway for anyone listening who might be starting a new business.
Yeah.
If you're thinking about, you know, claiming lost profits down the line, you absolutely need rock solid evidence.
Mm-hmm. You got it.
I'm starting to see the whole picture here. But what does that kind of evidence actually look like in the real world? Like, what specific proof would make a difference in a case like this?
That's a great question. And that's where we get into the real nitty gritty of this case. And that's where we'll pick up in part two of our deep dive.
You've got to be kidding me. Another cliffhanger. All right, listeners, you'll just have to stay tuned to find out what kind of proof can, you know, make or break a lost profits claim. We'll see you in part two.
Welcome back to our deep dive into Drew's Covey Led with Wolf. Last time we were talking about, you know, what kind of evidence a new business really needs to prove lost profits.
Yeah, and it sounds like it's not as simple as just, you know, throwing out some numbers like the restaurant owners did in this case.
Not at all. The court was very clear that, you know, vague estimates and unsupported testimony just won't cut it. You need to show those lost profits with reasonable certainty.
Okay, reasonable certainty. That sounds, I mean, I get the concept. But what does that actually look like, you know, in a real world situation? Like, how does a new business actually go about making that case?
Well, imagine this. You're basically building this financial roadmap that's so detailed, so well supported, that it leaves no room for doubt. It's like taking a business plan and supercharging it with real evidence that could stand up in court.
All right, I'm kind of intrigued now. Let's break this down step by step. What kind of documentation are we talking about here?
So first off, you'd want to see some really comprehensive financial projections. And I'm not just talking about revenue here. We're talking like detailed breakdowns of costs, you know, factoring in everything, rent, utilities, staffing, marketing expenses, the whole nine yards.
So it's about painting a picture for the court of what the financial situation would have been if, you know, if everything had gone according to plan, if the contract hadn't been breached.
Exactly. You're showing them, you know, not just what you think you would have made, but how you arrived at that number, all the different pieces of the puzzle.
And I'm guessing it's not enough to just, you know, pull these projections out of thin air. Right?
Oh, absolutely not. They need to be grounded in real data, realistic assumptions.
So what kind of data are we talking about? What would make these projections convincing?
Well, industry benchmarks are really crucial here. You'd want to show how similar businesses in the same area, you know, or even just national averages for that type of business, how they typically perform financially.
So you're basically saying, you know, look, other restaurants in this area with this kind of concept, they usually make this much money. It's like using comparable properties in real estate, but for business.
That's a great analogy. Mm-hmm. And then there's another really powerful tool that you could use. Expert testimony.
Yes, bringing in the big guns.
Exactly, bringing in like a financial expert, an economist, maybe even a seasoned industry consultant. That can add a lot of weight to your case.
Yeah, I can see how that would be really persuasive. I mean, an expert could really explain those numbers, analyze the market conditions, really drive home the point that these lost profits are more than just a guess.
Right. A credible expert can really connect the dots for the court between, you know, the breach of contract and the actual financial harm that the business suffered.
Okay, so we've got these detailed financial projections, industry benchmarks, expert testimony. It seems like all that working together could create a pretty clear and convincing picture of those lost profits. But let's play devil's advocate here for a minute. Let's say the restaurant owners in Drew's Co., they came to court with that kind of evidence. Do you think they would have won their claim for lost profits?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? And unfortunately, there's no easy answer. Even with the best evidence proving those lost profits for a new business, it's always a challenge.
Come on, you're the expert here. Give me your best guess. What do you think?
All right. Well, even with a mountain of evidence, it's never a slam dunk. It still comes down to, you know, the specific circumstances of the case, how the judge or jury interprets the evidence, and the arguments made by both sides.
So even with all the proof in the world, there's still that element of uncertainty.
Absolutely. And that's why Drew's Co. is such an important case. It really highlights the importance of careful planning, you know, meticulous documentation and solid legal guidance, especially when it comes to new businesses and these tricky lost profit claims.
So basically, you can't eliminate the risk entirely, but you can definitely minimize it by being prepared.
Exactly.
But we've been focusing a lot on what new businesses need to do. What about the contractors in all of this? What lessons can they learn from Drew's Co.?
Well, for contractors, this case is a really clear reminder that timelines matter, even if they aren't spelled out in the contract. That reasonable time standard, it can cut both ways.
So relying on a lack of a deadline to justify delays, that's not the best strategy.
No, not at all. Contractors need to be proactive about setting clear expectations, communicating any potential issues early on, and really importantly, documenting everything.
Right, because if things do go sideways, those records become your best defense. Documentation is key for both contractors and new businesses. But it seems like most people, they don't really think about, you know, potential legal battles when they're starting a project or launching a business. It's not exactly the most exciting part of the process.
No, it's not. But this case, it really serves as a wake-up call. It shows just how important it is to get good legal advice right from the start.
Because a good lawyer can help you, you know, spot those potential problems, draft contracts that protect you, and make sure you're prepared if things go wrong.
Exactly. And that brings us to one of the most important takeaways from Drew's Co., this crucial role of evidence. Whether you're a contractor or a new business owner or just, you know, anyone entering into a contract, understanding how to prove your case is essential.
It's not enough to just be right. You got to be able to back it up.
100%. And that's a lesson that applies way beyond construction disputes or lost profit claims. It's really a fundamental principle of our legal system.
Okay, so let's try to wrap all of this up, synthesize it. What are the key takeaways our listeners should really remember from this deep dive into Drew's Co. v. Ledwith Wolf?
We've covered a lot of ground, but it really comes down to three main points. First, that concept of reasonable time, it's crucial in contracts, even when there's not a specific deadline.
Right. And second, new businesses can claim lost profits, but they really need to meet a higher evidentiary standard. Detailed financial projections, industry benchmarks, expert testimony. It's not easy, but it it can be done.
And then third, documentation is everything. Whether you're a contractor keeping those records or a new business owner tracking your financials, those records, they could make or break your case down the line.
It's like they say, if it wasn't documented, it didn't happen.
Exactly. And I think it's also worth emphasizing again that seeking legal guidance from the very beginning, it can save you a lot of trouble later on. A good lawyer can help you navigate these complexities and make sure your interests are protected.
Well said. Now, before we wrap up our deep dive into DrewsCon, there's one more thing about this case that I find really interesting. The way the court dealt with this whole concept of reasonableness, it was fascinating. It almost seemed like they were moving away from those rigid legal rules and taking a more flexible approach, you know, one that's really specific to the context. What do you think that means for the future of contract law? Are we moving towards a world where reasonableness is like the deciding factor in every case?
That's a great question, and it's one that we'll explore a bit further in part three of our deep dive.
Another cliffhanger. All right, you've convinced me. I'm coming back for more. Listeners, we'll be right back with the final part of our deep dive into Drew's Covey Led with Wolf, where we'll tackle that question of reasonableness and what it all means for contract law. Don't go anywhere.
Welcome back to the final part of our deep dive into Drew's Covey Led with Wolf. You know, before we went to break, we were talking about how the court's focus on this reasonableness idea, it might actually signal like a real shift in how we think about contract law in general.
Yeah, it's definitely thought-provoking, right? I mean, are we moving towards this world where reasonableness like trumps everything else in a contract?
Yeah.
Do the actual words like even matter anymore?
I mean, those are the kind of questions that keep me up at night, but I'm guessing it's not quite that simple.
You're right to be a little wary. This reasonableness standard, it's not a get out of jail free card for ignoring contracts altogether. It's still, you know, rooted in legal principles and all the precedents that came before it.
Okay.
It's more about acknowledging that real life situations they can get pretty messy. And sometimes sticking to a rigid interpretation of a contract, it just doesn't fit. So it gives judges and juries like a little more wiggle room, you know, to consider the specifics of each case.
Exactly. And that's where things get really interesting, because this whole idea of reasonableness, it can be super subjective, right? What seems reasonable to one person might seem totally out there to someone else. It all depends on your perspective.
Yeah, that's what worries me a little bit. How do we even prevent this from just turning into a free-for-all, where everyone's just, you know, arguing their own version of reasonable? It seems like it could get pretty chaotic in the courtroom.
That is the challenge, and it's a big part of why this case, Drew's Co., is so important. It really underscores the importance of clear communication from the start, you know, careful documentation throughout the process, and this willingness to really try to understand different perspectives. It's not enough to just, you know, say you're right. You got to be able to prove that your actions were reasonable given the circumstances.
So it's not just about being right. It's about being able to show that you acted reasonably.
Yeah.
You know, considering everything that was going on at the time.
Precisely. And that requires, you know, kind of a shift in how we think about things, both for lawyers and for anyone who's involved in creating or signing a contract.
Okay.
We need to be more proactive, more thoughtful about how our actions might be perceived and how we can make a strong case for reasonableness if a dispute pops up later on.
It almost feels like we're moving away from this world of black and white legal rules and into more of a gray area, you know, where context and evidence become even more critical.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. And this shift, it really has the potential to make contract law more adaptable to different situations, more fair in the long run, and more responsive to the realities of doing business in the modern world.
Okay.
But it also adds this whole new layer of complexity to everything.
It does. So what's the bottom line here? What should our listeners really take away from all of this discussion?
I think the biggest takeaway, the most important thing to remember is to get good legal advice early on in the process.
Okay.
A good lawyer, they can help you sort through all of these really complex issues, help you write contracts that are clear and cover all the bases, and really help you, you know, build a strong argument for reasonableness, you know, just in case something goes wrong down the line.
Yeah, and that's something we've been emphasizing this whole episode. And it's worth saying again, having that legal expertise on your side can really make all the difference.
Right.
Well, folks, that brings us to the end of our deep dive into Drews Covey Led with Wolf.
Mm.
It's a case that might be over 20 years old, but the lessons it teaches about contracts, about fairness in legal agreements, and about how the law itself is always evolving. I mean, those are more relevant today than ever.
They really are. It reminds us that the law, it's not static, it's constantly changing, and we all have a role to play in shaping how it evolves. We can't just, you know, rely on outdated rules and assumptions. We got to be proactive, you know, we got to stay informed and be ready to adapt to new challenges as they come up.
Well said. So that's it for this episode of The Deep Dive. We hope you found this journey through Drews Covey Led with Wolf insightful and engaging. We'd love to hear, you know, your thoughts on this case and what this whole idea of reasonableness means to you.
Until next time, stay curious and keep those contracts airtight.